subjects and posterity. He was a successful warrior, but also a powerful image maker. Success, victory, martial valour, chivalry, Englishness. These were the ideas that Edward promoted. He'd set out his stall, so you might as well queue up and buy a venison burger with some special Plantagenet sauce and an iced mead. There's a joust at 2, but don't worry, the lances are made of sponge. What's so great about glory? It's often gory. Edward III's almost always was. Glory is overrated. People get hurt in the quest for glory, and not just the glory seekers. Then the glory itself is fleeting. There's a moment and then it passes. It's not a film. The broadswordsmanship is too realistic, and the climax isn't the end. The credits haven't rolled, so life goes on, and all that glory is gradually whittled down to something only old people remember. Fraying at both ends. Let's start at the two ends of Edward III's reign and work inwards. The two ends weren't great. The first end was, as with a piece of string, also the beginning, and it was a strange one. Edward's father was still alive, which, under more normal circumstances, would have been a nice thing. As it was, it complicated matters. In late January 1327, after Parliament had decided the country desperately needed to move on to the next king, even though he was a pubescent boy, a delegation of noblemen went to Kenilworth Castle, where Edward II was being held, in order to talk him into abdicating. He made a bit of a fuss about it, as you might expect. He became tearful and had to be held upright because the shock had made him weak at the knees. But he was persuaded when the nobleman started saying that if he resigned the throne, his son would succeed him and the Plantagenet dynasty would continue. But if he didn't, both he and his son might be sidelined and a new candidate found. So he agreed to abdicate, and his steward of the household, Sir Thomas Blunt, ceremonially broke his staff of office in front of everyone. Dramatic. Good work, Sir Thomas. That's a nifty bit of protocol to come up with on the spur of the moment. And it's risky. You've got to be sure people will get what you're doing, rather than think it's an accident or a weird moment of temper. It could easily have resulted in a terse, "Tom, can you please keep still? This is actually quite a stressful moment for everyone." Not only did they all realise what was going on, but now there was a thing that must be done when kings stop being kings. Staffs of office get broken. How reassuring that must have been for the anxious magnates. Suddenly there's a system and a ceremony, almost like a coronation. So what they were doing can't be an offence against God and nature after all. Also, it answered the question that must have occurred to Sir Thomas and many of his predecessors: what is a staff of office actually for? How much of the day-to-day stewarding work involves the use of a stick? Very little, I'd have thought. The stick must, more often than not, have been an impediment. Just something you have to put down somewhere in order to do anything that involves two hands. Now everyone knew what it was for. It's there to be broken when the reign ends. It could act as a warning to future kings. You're just one snap across the knee away from being busted back to civilian, Your Majesty. I wonder if, 6 Edwards later, Wallace Simpson's fiancée had a stick broken in front of him. Yet another thing for him to whinge to Hitler about. On the 1st of February 1327, Edward III, just 14 years old at that point, was crowned king. Meanwhile, his dad was in prison, thinking he should still be king, and his mum, Queen Isabella, was both running the country and very publicly shacked up with her new boyfriend, Roger Mortimer. The teenage king must have been so embarrassed. If they'd been competent regents, Edward might have been able to cope with it all until he reached the age of majority. But they weren't. They made a humiliating peace with France and another with Scotland, having fought a terrible military campaign that nearly got Edward himself captured. Plantagenet territory and rights were being frittered away to north and south. Former King Edward II was also nearly captured, but in his case the attempts were made by well-wishers hoping to restore him to power. He was moved from Kenilworth to Berkeley Castle, which Mortimer hoped would be more secure. But the hoping didn't quite hit the spot, so in September 1327, Mortimer had him murdered just to be on the safe side. Almost certainly, that is. It's almost certain that it was murder by order of Mortimer and or Isabella, just as it's almost certain that the method employed was not red-hot poker up the bottom. The most disappointing failing in Mortimer and Isabella was that they were obsessed with increasing their own personal wealth, awarding themselves vast new estates, and, in the case of Mortimer, inventing the new earldom of March, as in the Welsh marches or the border areas, to give to himself. I don't understand their reasoning. What were they feathering their nests for? Weren't they comfortably off already? Didn't Mortimer realise his only future lay in retaining power, and he could do this only by appeasing, and ideally impressing, the rest of the aristocracy and the adolescent king? Was he hoping to retire on these riches? He was a usurper of royal power. People like that don't retire. They're either still running the show or they're dead. As Edward got older and more frustrated by the position he found himself in, Mortimer became more presumptuous and tyrannical and deferred to the young king less and less, even in public. When, in March 1330, Mortimer had the Earl of Kent, a son of Edward I, executed, the king realised he had to do something. In October that year, he launched a coup to gain control of his own kingdom. This involved creeping into Nottingham Castle with a bunch of mates, bursting into his mother's bedroom, and arresting Roger. "Fair son, have pity on the gentle Mortimer," said Isabella. But Edward didn't. Mortimer was hanged as a traitor at Tyburn, the famous London gallows, roughly where Marble Arch is now, on the 29th of November 1330. Edward III's proper rule had begun. It lasted for nearly half a century. At the other end, Edward III lived too long. His eldest son didn't live long enough. Those were the big problems at the other end of the reign. There'd been a hell of a lot of glory, and I'll get to that, but it had petered out. Then, in 1369, Edward's wife, Queen Philippa of Hainaut, on whom he was exceptionally keen and who had been a very effective partner in his rule, died. The following year, his eldest son Edward, who, all being well, would have been Edward V one day, also died. By then, his father, Edward Prince of Wales, who, all being well, would have been Edward IV one day, was already ailing from a mysterious chronic illness. In 1376, he died. Meanwhile, Edward III, who, all being well, would have stopped being Edward III by now, was still just about going. But he was a shadow of his former self, possibly suffering from dementia, or perhaps he had a stroke. Either way, he was relying heavily for the location of his marbles on his mistress, Alice Perrers, and she didn't always act in the national interest. The government had been spending vast sums on military campaigns which were no longer proving successful, and there was widespread suspicion of corruption in the doddering King's Council. In 1376, a parliament, subsequently known as the Good Parliament, during which the Prince of Wales died — those two facts are not connected, though the name implies the parliamentarians managed to keep their grief under control — made a decent stab at sorting all this out. For the first time, senior royal officials were impeached for corruption and new ministers imposed on the king, and an attempt made to separate him from Alice Perrers. Towards the end of the session, soon after the prince's death, the commons, an increasingly powerful and confident force within the good parliament, made a demand. They wanted his surviving son, Richard of Bordeaux, who was then a 9-year-old boy, to be brought before them and confirmed as the heir apparent. They were worried that Edward III's eldest surviving son, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, who had been heading up the regime's responses to the parliament's complaints, might otherwise attempt to usurp the throne. This is interesting. As it happens, John of Gaunt didn't try to usurp the throne, though he probably considered it. He swore an oath on the Prince of Wales's deathbed, along with his father, to honour and protect young Richard's accession. What's weird is how convinced everyone seems to have been that Gaunt becoming king would be such a terrible idea. He wasn't a brilliant man, but he was okay. He was a competent and experienced military leader and politician. In his dealings with the good parliament, he was a bit unreconstructedly pro-crown, but members of the royal family tend to be like that. The next parliament, Edward III's last, which is known to posterity as the bad parliament, was dominated by Gaunt and reversed many of the good parliament's reforming steps. So he wasn't very parliamentarian in his outlook, but still there's no reason to think he wouldn't have made a decent king and was surely a better bet than a child. But by now, the principle of primogeniture was carrying all before it. The realm had got so used to that certainty, that complete knowledge of who the next king is going to be, that it won't entertain the notion of any other ruler. John of Gaunt was a senior international figure, a loyal son of Edward III, and a major part of the very successful regime Edward had run for the last several decades. Yet the idea of Gaunt becoming king has become heresy, because the child Richard, helpless though he was, has the magical primogeniture fairy dust that now trumps the anointing oil coronation magic. Clearly there was a feeling that if you go against the righteousness of primogeniture, things might go badly wrong. Needless to say, they did anyway. Perhaps Parliament was now sufficiently self-confident that the magnates and knights actively wanted a child on the throne because they reckoned that would give them the chance to run the country for a bit, keep a control on spending, and prevent dynastic ambition on the continent from making everyone go broke. A key figure here was a knight of the Shire called Sir Peter de la Mare, the first elected Speaker of the House of Commons. More than anyone else, Peter de la Mare set the good Parliament's agenda, and he was, by the standards of the day, a very ordinary bloke. He wasn't an aristocrat or a magnate or anything close to it. He'd been a toll collector and the Earl of March's steward, and now he had been elected to a position of considerable importance. Doesn't that have a pleasing, tingly, anachronistic ring to it? Obviously, he was very, very high up the social order compared to most people, but it shows that the influence of the commons was giving a much wider cross-section of society access to power, even if it was still a very narrow cross-section by modern standards, the number of Etonians in most contemporary cabinets notwithstanding. The idea that someone as unposh as de la Mare might be able to instigate rules that directly affected the behaviour of big players like Gaunt and even the king would have been unthinkable a century earlier. The commons were comfortable wielding this power. No sense of deferring to their betters seems to hamper them. Primogeniture and coronation carry weight. The king is treated with enormous reverence, but it's not unthinking reverence. Meanwhile, notions of royalty and aristocracy seemed to be carrying less weight. As the vertiginous hierarchy of feudalism became simplified, rulers were increasingly holding their lands in full sovereignty, directly below God, rather than by paying homage to more senior rulers. There was less respect for aristocrats and relatives of the king. They, the commons seemed to think, are not to be trusted. I'm talking about the confused and discontented end to Edward's reign before I get to the good bit, because the end makes much of what went before seem futile. It felt splendid at the time, but it led nowhere, and for me, it helps to keep that in mind. Edward inherited and bequeathed a bankrupt kingdom, failing to live up to its own unrealistic expectations on the international scene. What happened in between is a detail. The Glorious Middle. In between these two periods of disappointment and corruption, there were some stellar triumphs. Edward III and his son Prince Edward were great strategists, warriors, and propagandists. They furthered Plantagenet claims in France more forcefully than anyone since Henry II. The aspect of their success that is most treasured by posterity, in Britain at least, was their knack for winning battles when outnumbered. At Crecy in 1346 and Poitiers in 1356, smaller English armies thrashed larger French ones due to the senior English royals' strategic excellence and the brilliance of the English and Welsh longbowmen. The French only had crossbowmen, who were comparatively shit, plus men in armour on horses who you'd imagine, from their habit of repeatedly riding into blizzards of arrows, actively wanted to get shot to bits. As a result of these battles, a huge proportion of the senior French aristocracy ended up lying around the French countryside dead in their armour. And there were other English triumphs. Calais was conquered in 1347 after a long siege and remained in English hands for over 200 years. At the Battle of Poitiers, King John II of France was captured and taken back to England. In 1360, as part of the Treaty of Bretigny, his ransom was set at 3 million crowns, which roughly equates to, "Oh, mother of God, you are fucking kidding me," in today's money. And he was allowed to go home to try and raise it, on the condition that he left his son, Louis of Anjou, as a hostage. This was all quite humiliating for the French monarchy, but it got worse. In 1363, Louis managed to escape before the ransom had been paid. Well done him, you might think. That's not what John II thought. He considered the escape to be dishonourable. It was reneging on an agreement, so the king voluntarily returned to English captivity himself. We can only imagine how annoying the people of France and his son Louis found this extravagant act of virtue signalling. This is finding 10p on the pavement and insisting on handing it in at a local police station raised to the geopolitical level. Then, in 1364, John died in English captivity. For the French royal family, this was a time of deep crisis. It was compounded by the fact that not everyone accepted that that family, the House of Valois, really was the French royal family. Edward III didn't. In his view, he was the rightful King of France. This was a strange state of affairs. On the face of it, Edward III was about as unlike the King of France as it was possible for a king to be. He styled himself very definitely as the King of England. He was the first ruler since the Conquest who stressed this Englishness. He was still a French-speaking international blue blood by background, but he spoke and promoted the English language. In the Statute of Pleading of 1362, he changed the language which was to be spoken in England's law courts and in Parliament from the Norman French of the Royal Court to English. As with the Declaration of Arbroath, this is a sign of a nascent pre-nationalism developing in Europe. The king was citing and valuing, declaring ownership of, the concept of Englishness. It had taken 3 centuries for the descendants of William the Conqueror to start doing this. Previously, they emphasised their royalty, their kingliness, their righteous possession of their lands, but didn't trouble to lay claim to having anything in common with the millions of people whose fate they controlled. God and their right was the order of the day, not issues of nationality, which were deemed beneath the contempt of Plantagenet internationalists. That was changing, and Edward was using that change and driving it. It seems perverse, perhaps hypocritical, that at the same time he was making a dynastic claim to be King of France. Let me try and briefly explain this dynastic claim while we're here, because, as I mentioned before, it resulted in the ludicrous situation that every ruler of England from the mid-14th century until the start of the 19th claimed also to be the rightful ruler of France. 500 years of delusional bullshit rested on this, which makes the couple of decades for which the United Nations pretended Taiwan was China pale into insignificance. For all this time, from Edward III onwards, the Lions of England on the Royal Coat of Arms were quartered with the fleur-de-lis of the French royal family. And if, as some think, those 3 lions aren't all English, but one is for Normandy and one for Aquitaine, lands which the English crown controlled only for fleeting periods during the subsequent centuries, that would make the symbolism of the Royal Coat of Arms over 80% delusional. Well, why not? The first kings, as we've seen, were just successful bullies. All the talk of religion and legitimacy is a distraction from that fundamental truth. I find the absurd claim to France of the English monarchs an amusing reminder that all these people with crowns are just chancers. Now then, the dynastic claim. In itself, it was reasonable. When Charles IV died in 1328, there was no direct male heir. It was the end of the line for the House of Capet, which had been the French royal house for nearly 350 years. Edward III's mother, Isabella, was Charles's sister and the daughter of Philip IV. By Edward's reckoning, that made him the next eligible male in line. Women were officially not allowed to be the sovereign in France, rather than merely effectively not allowed, which, as we know from Matilda's experience, was the situation in England. So Isabella was out of the running, but Edward argued that she could still transmit eligibility across the generations from Philip IV to him. The counter-argument, put forward by the French, who reckoned the King of England also being their king would be less than ideal, was that a right can't be transferred by someone who can't hold it. If you can't carry it, you can't pass it on. It makes sense in physics. So, in 1328, after a brief pause to see whether Charles's pregnant widow would give birth to a boy, it was a girl, Philip VI of Valois was crowned king. He was Charles IV's cousin and Philip IV's nephew, so he was a more distant relative than Edward III, but was related entirely through men. That was why, in 1340, a few years into his reign, and after he'd paid homage to Philip VI for Aquitaine, Edward suddenly turned round and said he was King of France. It's opportunism, albeit based on an arguable dynastic claim. By the way, in case you're trying to keep track of this blizzard of French kings, the John II I mentioned as having been captured by Edward was Philip VI's son. Edward didn't behave at all like a Frenchman trying to reclaim his birthright. It would have been tricky to do that, I suppose. He was pushing his Englishness hard at home. He couldn't claim to also possess an innate Frenchness to go with his innate Englishness. So he didn't bother to try. He put the fleur-de-lis on all his stuff and went to war. A war in which, whatever the dynastic argument, what was really happening was that the King of England was trying to conquer France. That's what spoils Edward and his son's valiant underdog image. Yes, they were often outnumbered, and yes, they were very brave and militarily astute. But they were also invaders and aggressors. If burglars find themselves outnumbered by the residents of a house they're attempting to clear out, that doesn't necessarily make them particularly sympathetic. Being away from home put the invaders at a disadvantage some of the time, but it also gave them carte blanche to trash the place without destroying their own homes. They perfected a tactic known as the chevauchée, which was basically wasting, that beloved technique of William the Conqueror, but done at speed. An army on horseback, cutting a swathe of destruction through the countryside, killing, burning, and ruining the lives of hundreds of thousands of French peasants. Edward, Prince of Wales, used the chevauchée particularly effectively and mercilessly, and there is speculation that this is why he came to be known as the Black Prince. Heart of Darkness. In 1348, right in the middle of Edward III's reign, after Crecy but before Poitiers, two things happened. The king founded England's highest order of chivalry, the most noble order of the Garter, and the Black Death reached England. The Knights of the Garter, whose founder members were the king, the Black Prince, and 24 other spunky worthies, are still a big part of British establishmentarian imagery. The monarch and the heir to the throne are always members, as well as other ageing big shots. Retired generals, admirals, governors of the Bank of England, heads of MI5, and former prime ministers. There was a bit of a stink recently about Tony Blair being made one on the basis that he was a warmonger. The idea that that might disqualify him couldn't be more out of keeping with the spirit of the order that Edward III founded. The dashing yet august aura of this institution, with just a touch of sexiness coming from its association with a saucy item of clothing, is a testament to Edward's skill as an image maker. The order was dedicated to St George, who was then elevated to co-patron saint of England alongside St Edward the Confessor. It's delightful to see the tedious old confessor shunted aside, and great fun to have a patron saint whose most famous act, killing a dragon, is literally impossible. But for Edward III, George's USP was his martial valour. The Order of the Garter was key to the king's branding of his regime as English, and also, as epitomised by St George, warlike. And the place the English were supposed to be warlike, according to Edward, was France. Ever since King John lost Normandy, Plantagenet kings had struggled to get their English magnates to become involved in and agree to bankroll wars of reconquest in France. Once the major aristocrats ceased to hold lands on both sides of the Channel, fighting on the continent stopped being in their own interests. Somehow Edward got over this problem. His stunning successes, his inspiring leadership, and his conscious evocation of chivalry and nationalism turned the English magnates into hawks. They wanted to fight in France. It had become something they were supposed to do. Indeed, Edward's successor, Richard II, found himself in the opposite position to most of his predecessors. He didn't want to fight in France, but his barons pressurised him to do so. That's how influential Edward III's regal marketing strategy was. The Garter was all about warlike Englishness, but it also had a French motto, just to underline Edward's claim to the French throne. That motto, Honi soit qui mal y pense, usually translated as shame on him who thinks evil of it, doesn't really mean much, but insofar as it means anything, is completely self-serving. It's basically, we're great and if you don't agree you can fuck off. Or possibly, I'm King of France, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off and I may try to kill you. It's wrapped round the royal coat of arms to this day, long outlasting the nonsensical fleur-de-lis, so it's on all British passports, birth certificates, the adverts of any company with a royal warrant, the front pages of every edition of the Times and the Daily Mail, and the walls of all courtrooms. As a piece of branding and image-making, it shits on any hashtag. Even as this order was being founded, in the midst of English triumphs in France, something far more significant was happening that doesn't seem to find a place in Edward's narrative. Bubonic plague was sweeping the world. Emerging in Eurasia in around 1346 and spreading westwards with trade and rats, the Black Death, as it was known, condemned just under half the population to an excruciating death. And that was just the first wave. It's worth taking a moment to contemplate what that means. Nearly half of everyone suddenly died, or pretty suddenly, over a few months to a year. And it wasn't just poor people, or just rich people, or just soldiers, or just children, or just men, or just women. It was every other person going all hot and screaming and covered in agonising swellings, and then totally still and stinking. They'd already had rough lives, these people, by our standards. Most of their kids died, just as standard, and people who made it to adulthood didn't live long. Random death was always a possibility. They were tough back then. Life was viewed differently, valued differently. But even taking all that into account, the impact of the Black Death must still have been so terrible as to be almost surreal. It's probably the worst thing that has ever happened to humanity. It must have driven everyone who was left alive absolutely mental with grief and post-traumatic stress. They seem weird, the people of the past, but for a few decades after the Black Death, they've got a bloody good excuse because everyone, the whole of society, had just undergone a horrific experience on the level of being stuck in a particularly bad bit of the Battle of the Somme. Not as noisy, but even more deadly. It's impossible to understand how or why they coped. Being human, a key coping mechanism was guilt, but a sort of arrogant, self-aggrandizing guilt. This must be our fault, everyone thought, in a maelstrom of self-loathing and self-involvement. God is angry with us, and that's why this is happening. Aren't we careless, powerful fools? Curse us, for we have become too mighty. I am thoroughly convinced by the overwhelming scientific evidence of humanity's role in climate change and the consequent need to inhabit the planet less impactfully. That fact is beyond doubt, and those who do doubt it imperil our survival. Let me get that on record first. However, the only meaningful counter-argument that could be made is that humanity always thinks it's responsible for everything. We always reckon it's about us. We love taking credit for things, but where no credit is available, we'll settle for blame rather than entertaining the horrendously humbling notion that something, anything at all, might have nothing to do with us. The reason the climate change deniers seldom make that potentially persuasive argument is that they're even more weak-mindedly obsessed with human significance than average, so their arguments are all based on conspiracies and secrets and other malevolent aspects of human agency. They're not up for the we-had-nothing-to-do-with-this narrative at all. They just opt for a different pattern of blaming humans because they're delusional fuckwits who don't understand science. The Black Death had nothing meaningful to do with humans. Human trade drove its spread, the close cohabitation of humans incentivized its emergence, but no person or people had done a stupid or sinful thing to cause it. It existed because we existed. I don't think you can blame humans any more than you can blame chickens for foxes. Still, I hope the solemn, self-important guilt that people resorted to in their bewilderment and grief gave them some sort of comfort, some feeling of significance in the face of a bacterial tsunami for which they were no more than a fertile shore. This happened at the core of Edward III's reign, in the middle of the first phase of what's going to be known as, spoiler alert, the Hundred Years' War. Under such circumstances, some people might forget about trying to be king of France. It might feel like it didn't really matter, like all those battles and slaughter were a bit hollow now half of everyone, both in England and France, had dropped down dead like it was the rapture but smellier. It spoils the glory, which isn't Edward III's fault. He didn't cause the Black Death, and his government responded to it about as well as any. The Statute of Labourers of 1351 sought to control wages, which, by the law of supply and demand, were skyrocketing now so many people were dead. It feels a bit spiteful to deny poor survivors the pay rise that was the silver lining of the nation's infinite cloud of grief, but it stabilised the situation for the ruling class. Stability, peace and competence were hallmarks of Edward's domestic regime. He probably deserves more credit for that than for his showier but more ephemeral military successes. Edward III had a bloody good go, an extremely bloody good go, at taking control of France. At his height, he was in charge of a similar area to Henry II, but unlike Henry II, he had taken the step of claiming that he ought to be in charge of all of it as the rightful King of France. In the Treaty of Bretigny of 1360, however, he temporarily dropped that claim in exchange for holding all of his vast lands in full sovereignty rather than having to pay homage, and for the vast amount of cash that was John II's ransom. By the end of his reign, Edward had reverted to saying he was King of France while controlling hardly any of it. But the Black Death is such a reminder of mortality, of the futility of human endeavour, that it makes the grandiose enterprise of conquest, successful though it usually was during Edward's reign, seem dafter than ever. Dafter than during Henry III's failed expeditions, dafter than when John or Edward I couldn't persuade any barons to come to France with him. All that dying makes you fall back on vacuous truisms. Nothing matters more than health and family. Edward III had both, then he had neither. Did he understand that? Possibly. He was no fool. Unlike his grandfather, he understood nuance. Chivalry, the notion of such honour in a murderous martial context, is a nuanced idea. The Black Prince may have understood it too. This renowned warrior's tomb is in Canterbury Cathedral, where there is a bronze effigy of him in full armour, looking almost exactly like a Cyberman. In his will, he asked for the following poem to be inscribed around it. Such as thou art, sometime was I. Such as I am, such shalt thou be. I thought little on the hour of death, so long as I enjoyed breath. On earth I had great riches, land, houses, great treasure, horses, money and gold. But now a wretched captive am I. Deep in the ground, lo, here I lie. My beauty great is all quite gone. My flesh is wasted to the bone. In his slow decline from renown into sickness, he must have realized that, when it comes to the human condition, glory only treats the symptoms. Chapter 25. King Richard II. It is a lamentable fact that the care system fails many of the children entrusted to it. A family environment needs to be exceptionally terrible, murderously, malevolently endangering, before a child isn't better off there than in care. It's a sad failure of the state, and calls into question the extreme fastidiousness of the adoption process. Good luck adopting if you smoke, but the outcomes for children brought up in households of smokers are on average far better than for those whose childhoods are spent in care. But the adoption system is not held accountable for the failings of the care system, only for the shortcomings of any parents they allow to adopt. It's the same principle as not allowing someone to get into your lifeboat because it has insufficient fire extinguishers. Richard II was brought up in care, and it fucked him up. I don't think John of Gaunt smoked, he'd have been ahead of his time, but the system considered him an inappropriate influence on the young king. Parliament and the magnates jealously protected Richard from Gaunt and his other uncles, afraid of the power they might concentrate in their own hands if given control of the young king. As a result, the child was denied the consolations of family. The previous king, his grandfather, also acceded to the throne as a minor, and his home life was far from ideal. His mother was shagging an ex-con with whom she conspired to imprison and murder his father. This should have been a red flag for social services. But Edward, despite having his mother's lover executed, had a better upbringing than Richard, and this may have been one of the reasons he was a far superior king. One of the many strengths of Edward III's regime was that his own family, his wife and children, was close and loyal, so we must suspect loving. Unlike Henry II's sons, none of Edward III's ever rebelled, even though he was greatly enfeebled for his last few years. Henry, conversely, had remained a competent and energetic king until his final weeks, but was run ragged by his own children's determination to supplant him. The sons of Edward who survived him, Gaunt, plus Edmund of Langley and Thomas of Woodstock, weren't like that. Nevertheless, when Richard became king at the age of 10, Parliament and the magnates swerved any sort of official regency run by his uncles and pretended that Richard could exercise power for himself. He couldn't, but that was the pretense. He was nominally conducting affairs with the help of a series of continual councils from which Gaunt was excluded. From the start, then, Richard was denied a replacement father figure, but was surrounded by groups of older men who were eager to please him and to exploit any influence they gained over him. The plan to stop Gaunt having too much influence may have succeeded, but it resulted in too much influence going to other men, most notably Michael de la Pole and Robert de Vere, whose power the magnates then feared and resented much more than that of Gaunt, who was at least a prince. As well as this absence of a focal figure of guidance and love, the other destabilizing oddity of Richard's childhood was the crazy level of reverence with which he was treated. His coronation in 1377 was an eye and ear bruisingly splendid occasion, a vast and glittering ceremony emphasizing Plantagenet power and legitimacy and the new monarch's claim to divine favor. The underlying nuances and political expediency of the event will surely have been lost on the lonely boy at the centre of it. It must have felt, quite simply, like he was being worshipped. He knew he wasn't a god, by which I mean he knew that the word could not properly be applied to him, but he must have felt like a god. The way he was treated can't have been far off the experience enjoyed in ancient Rome by Caligula, who officially declared himself a god. This isolated sense of divinity did not turn Richard into a team player. It was the very opposite of teaching him about the reality of kingship. None of the principles by which successful kings governed, even-handedness, predictability, immediate ruthlessness when required, were being conveyed to Richard. He was hearing only about his divine right. The absence of close family will have confirmed his feelings of singularity. No political common sense, no humility, and no empathy were being instilled. These people are revolting. Richard's greatest triumph happened early in his reign. It probably didn't do his damaged personality any good. I'm referring to his role in the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Everyone's pretty used to the idea that there was an event called the Peasants' Revolt in the Middle Ages. Even if you haven't heard of it, it sounds plausible. I'd revolt if I were a medieval peasant, we say to ourselves, with the self-confidence of people unafraid to complain about slow service in a Pizza Express. An uprising by the relentlessly shat-on rural poor sounds like the sort of thing that happens. But it's not. It hasn't been happening so far. This isn't the 19th century. For 1381, this is remarkable and very different from the other disasters befalling medieval English governments. This violence and threat to the regime have nothing to do with either the magnates or the commons in Parliament. It's much closer to an attempted popular revolution, and in history's eerie way of echoing and foreshadowing itself, it has striking similarities with events that feel pretty modern, like the French and Russian revolutions. When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? That little rhyme is from a sermon given by one of the revolt's leaders, John Ball, a priest who had been disgraced and imprisoned for his egalitarian views. It's a haunting couplet, its ghostliness coming not from Ball's past, but from his future, an ethereal notion moving back through time and settling in the clergyman's mind. I like the way the rhyme makes you stress the last syllable of gentleman, in a subtly contemptuous way. From the beginning, all men by nature were created alike, and our bondage or servitude came in by the unjust oppression of naughty men, the sermon continued. The idea that no person is fundamentally better than anyone else, plus the implication that the Bible and Christianity are rooted in that principle, feels anachronistic. Most of the kings we've looked at in this book wouldn't even understand the concept. It was absolutely not the way Richard II had been brought up to think. People were not considered to be, in any sense, all the same. The revolt was sparked off by the enormously unpopular poll tax. You may be familiar with this phrase from Margaret Thatcher's late 1980s, early 1990s version, which I mentioned earlier, and was officially called the Community Charge. By the end, though, not even government ministers were calling it that. The poll tax label stuck, and it wasn't meant as a compliment. It was an insult in Thatcher's time, partly because of the precedent of the disastrous 14th century version, and partly because of what the nickname implied. Poll is an old word for head, and a modern word for vote. Either way, that makes it a tax on people's existence and rights as a citizen. In both 20th and 14th century incarnations, it was a tax that everyone had to pay, and everyone had to pay the same amount. This wasn't the type of egalitarianism John Ball had in mind. These days, those who believe in that sort of equality tend to favour the free availability of guns over the free availability of healthcare. In the 1380s, no one believed in either. This poll tax was first raised by Parliament just before Edward III's death in an attempt to pay for the war in France. It was payable by everyone over the age of 14, no matter how impoverished, at the rate of 4 pence per person. This trivial payment for the rich was an intolerable burden on the poor. When a third poll tax started to be collected in 1381, it caused a huge uprising in Kent and Essex, led by, among others, Ball and a man called Wat Tyler. While the poll tax was the immediate cause of the insurrection, there was something else going on. The Black Death had changed the economic structure of rural England. Despite the government's attempt in the Statute of Labourers to control wages, the deeper law of supply and demand meant that the financial prospects of rural workers were much better than they had been before half of the population carked it. Yet the ruling class was determined to restrict wages, keep serfs tied to the land, and even, through these sumptuary laws, to prevent affluent peasants from buying clothing too lavish for their social station. It was this more well-to-do and ambitious peasantry who led the revolt, frustrated by the attempts of the government through local justices of the peace to keep them in their place. It's telling that among the rebels' first targets were places where government and tax records were kept. They sensed instinctively that, in trying to collect and hold information about ordinary people, what nowadays we'd call their data, someone powerful was depriving them of something. It's an instinct we do well to listen to when going online. The whole, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear approach to private information is predicated on state power being held in honest and ethical hands. That's not always the case. It certainly wasn't in 1381, and as a general rule, trusting the state doesn't make it more trustworthy. After assembling in the home counties, huge numbers of the rebels marched on London, where they nearly overthrew the Plantagenet regime. The Tower of London was stormed, John of Gaunt's Savoy Palace on the Strand was burned down, and many important people were lynched, most notably Simon Sudbury, who was both Archbishop of Canterbury and Chancellor of England, and Robert Hales, the Lord High Treasurer. John of Gaunt himself was out of town in the north of England, but his teenage son Henry Bolingbroke, of whom we'll hear much more later, escaped the rebels only by hiding in a cupboard. It was clear to the boy king that all the grown-ups around him were losing their heads, either metaphorically or literally. The power and rage of the revolt was something the magnates around him didn't know what to do about. There weren't anywhere near enough royal troops in London to deal with the rebels, so the king had to go and meet them and listen to their demands. It was at this point that his weird upbringing and personality came to the fore. Most children would have been frightened under such circumstances, but Richard had been brought up to believe that there was something special about him that no one else in the country possessed. This belief is probably why, when Richard met the rebels at Smithfield on the 15th of June, he saved the day. When the royal party arrived, Wat Tyler came over and addressed Richard with scandalous familiarity, calling him brother. By this point in the crisis, some groups of rebels had dispersed in response to the government's agreeing to all of their demands, so Richard asked Tyler why he and his followers had not done the same. Tyler replied angrily to this and demanded refreshment, which was duly provided. Next, an argument broke out between him and some of the royal entourage. The details are lost in the mists of time, obviously, but it culminated in Tyler being stabbed by the Mayor of London. He was mortally wounded, but not actually dead, and seemed very likely to cry treachery and call on his followers to attack the Plantagenet party. This was Richard's moment. He spurred his horse and rode towards the crowd, declaring, "I am your captain, follow me." They did. And that sorted out the peasants' revolt, basically. He was 14 years old. It was extremely brave and well-timed, and was the most successful moment of Richard's entire life. Part of the reason it worked was that the rebels were opposed not to kingship but to the class system. They didn't like the notion of gentlemen, they were suspicious of royal advisers and taxation, but they believed in monarchy. They considered themselves the true commons, who had been kept away from their noble and rightful king by his dishonest advisers. They bought into the notion of Richard's righteous leadership as much as the poor, addle-headed young king did himself. That was the one aspect of the regime that the peasants didn't question. His Majesty? In the end, the magnates did question it, though. Over the next few years, they questioned it like they'd never questioned it before, and having questioned it, it couldn't be unquestioned again. The process that England underwent in the last decade and a half of Richard's reign fundamentally weakened the institution of monarchy. That sounds like good news, doesn't it? It's a bit shit, the institution of monarchy. It's not fair. Some guy gets to be in charge of everything just because of who his dad was. It's not a good system. But it is a system of some sort. It's not anarchy. Richard is in charge, and that's that. One day he'll die, but until then he's king. We know where we are, and we can work on a coping strategy. Up to this point, it's all been about the coping strategies. Those august foundation stones of the great British tradition of liberty, Magna Carta and Parliament, are methods for dealing with kings who turn out to be assholes or idiots. And while nobody designed this system, it does make a certain amount of sense. Accept who the king is, but rein him in so he can't screw things up too badly. The long-lasting and widespread literary genre of mirrors for princes was another approach to this problem. Its most famous example is The Prince by Niccolò Machiavelli, written in the early 16th century, but it had been going for over a millennium by then, and there are dozens of these self-help guides for rulers, obsequious and patronising in equal measure. The flaw in this approach, obviously, is that the monarchs most in need of instruction are often those least aware of the fact, and so least likely to read an instructional manual. Nevertheless, accepting who the king is, and crucially, who the king is going to be, gripping the notion of primogeniture ever more tightly, is a good way of maximising stability. It means you don't really need to have a civil war every time a king dies, on top of all the civil wars you're having anyway. The idea is you stop things like the Stephen and Matilda situation with a totally inflexible and preordained line of succession, and you stop things like the King John situation with Magna Carta and Parliament. Both kinds of mega-crisis are precluded. But if you don't unquestioningly accept who the king is, everything gets a bit wobbly. There's a frightening new potential coping strategy. Change kings. That's sort of been tried once before, when Edward II was made to abdicate, but the next king was his eldest son, so it wasn't fully stress-tested. The new king's accession was hastened, no more. The certainty of succession was maintained. When the magnates got rid of Richard, and as you are probably inferring, they are going to get rid of him, and he didn't have a son, and someone else became king, well, suddenly the position of that king and every other king forever is weaker. Kings can be got rid of, but there's no system in place for how that's done or who gets to be the new king. As a result, English history in the 15th century is an absolute shitstorm. There's no way that it wouldn't have been better all round if they'd stuck with crappy Richard until he died. They could always have just murdered him. That would probably have gone better for everyone except Richard, and not significantly worse for him. He ended up getting murdered anyway, just not until after he had been deposed. Yes, he was deposed. The magnates tried to do it by the book, but the book didn't exist. They were writing the book as they went along. All the previous books said, "He's the king, deal with it." Unfortunately, Richard made it very difficult for the magnates to deal with it. He was awful. Feeble, petulant and narcissistic. Then, in the last few years of his reign, lethally vengeful. He was intensely status conscious. He was the first English king to insist on being addressed as Your Majesty, in emulation of the more twatty French court. And he was quick to fall into contemptuous rages, another bloody inheritor of the Plantagenet temper, once declaring to a parliament that wanted to change his circle of ministers and advisers that he wouldn't dismiss one scullion from his kitchen at their request. Scullion is an archaic term for a McJob. Obviously, the Commons didn't give a shit who his scullions were. At that point, 1386, they wanted him to sack his Chancellor, Michael de la Pole, and dismiss his favourite, Robert de Vere, whom Richard, in an act of magnate-baiting largesse, had just made Duke of Ireland. Duke of Ireland? Seriously? It's like Earl of Greece or Marquis of America. It sounds made up. And of course it is, as are all aristocratic titles. The trouble with this one is that it had only just been made up, and it's pretty clear what the agenda was. Duke was the highest noble title. It had only started being used in England by Edward III, also in emulation of the French, and ranked higher than Earl or Baron. And Ireland is bigger than the other places people tended to be dukes or earls or somethings of. They're usually locations on the scale of Warwick or York, maybe Sussex or Cornwall at most. Ireland is an altogether bigger entity. The lack of proportionality in the title inflamed the magnate's fear that Richard had lost his sense of proportion about the merits of Robert de Vere. It had unfortunate echoes of when Edward II, just under a century of aristocratic titular inflation earlier, made Piers Gaveston the Earl of Cornwall. Richard was fond of the memory of Edward II and tried to get him canonised. The notion that that idiot was in any way saintly is so absurd as to make Edward the Confessor seem momentarily worthy of the status. This enthusiasm of Richard's was another worrying sign that he didn't get what it took to be an effective king. His court was magnificent. He and his queen, Anne of Bohemia, to whom he was devoted, wanted everything to be opulent and intellectual and what today we'd probably call bohemian in a way that has no connection with Anne, who just happened to have been born in what is now the Czech Republic. They invested lavishly in jewellery, fine textiles, metalwork, art and crazy clothes. Westminster Hall was redeveloped with 15 life-size statues of kings and a hammer-beam roof which remains amazing to behold. And the royal palaces were made sumptuous. Plus, there were emerging writers in the English language at this time. Geoffrey Chaucer, John Gower and William Langland are the most prominent. They're often referred to as the Ricardian poets, in a rare positive note from posterity about this king. It's ironic because Richard doesn't seem to have been that into poetry, though Gower's 33,000-line Confessio Amantis said in its prologue that Richard commissioned it. Doesn't say he read it, mind you. But I can't talk. I haven't read a single syllable of any of those writers' work, and certainly won't until I've watched the box set of The Sopranos that has been gathering dust in my possession for a decade and a half. Still, it's good to have writers, and the fact that their works aren't exactly easy reading to the modern eye doesn't mean they weren't great, nor that the advance in English vernacular culture wasn't significant. So the lovely court in itself wasn't a problem, except that it was expensive and Richard utterly lost his shit when asked to account for his expenditure. A magnificent court can be a good way for a monarch to demonstrate and increase their power. Louis XIV of France created a dazzling court in Versailles, which meant that all his major noblemen were right there, under his thumb, not interfering with the actual government of the country. Louis used display and fashion cannily as a way of uniting people behind his rule and of making foreign regimes fear and respect him as a figure of intimidating grandeur. Richard had no such political strategy in mind, however, and his expensive court was just prissy and alienating to the powerful men of the realm. A good example of this is the Wilton Diptych, a work of art Richard commissioned towards the end of his reign. It shows how he wanted to project himself to other people and posterity. It's a picture of three saints, the patron saints of England, St. Edward the Confessor, Grr, and St. Edmund, as in Bury St. Edmund, the martyred king, plus St. John the Baptist, presenting a piously kneeling Richard to Mary and baby Jesus, who are surrounded by angels, all wearing Richard's badge, which was a white heart with a golden crown round its neck and a golden chain. It's very pretty, but it's not how Edward III or Henry II put themselves across. It fails in two ways. In one sense, it makes Richard look a bit pathetic. For a king with no martial inclination, it serves only to reinforce his critics' view that he was a soft-skinned weakling. He looks small and slight and childlike. Very odd self-presentation for a time when going to war was seen as the monarch's primary duty. But in another sense, he looks like a megalomaniac, with three saints hanging out with him, Jesus and Mary apparently thrilled to meet him, and astonishingly, an angelic host already wearing his branding. If you went into the office of the CEO of, say, Adidas, and there was a big picture of him, or her, but it'll be him, accompanied by some saints, meeting some angels, and they're all wearing Adidas-branded gear, then you'd make a mental note that the guy was tyrannical and tasteless in equal measure, and expect a scandal about the dysfunctional working environment in the upper echelons of the Adidas Corporation to break any day. Total eclipse of the heart. In Richard's reign, a scandal like that broke twice, in 1386 and 1399, and both times it resulted in a small civil war. In between those little wars, there was a period of competent government, which is boring, so I won't dwell on it. By the end of 1386, Richard's ineffectual and militarily unaggressive regime was causing consternation. The teenage king hadn't done anything brave since the Peasants' Revolt. As noted, Edward III's dashing reign had put an end to the magnate's disinclination to fight expensive wars in France. On the contrary, it was now something they felt English kings absolutely ought to do. King Richard disagreed. In his early reign, there'd been an unsuccessful attack on Flanders, led, bizarrely, by the Bishop of Norwich, and then a fruitless expedition to Scotland, led by Richard himself, which had resulted in the king falling out with John of Gaunt. Gaunt had then left the country in high dudgeon to go and try to become King of Castile. Meanwhile, the French were threatening to invade. This crisis, coupled with the general dissatisfaction with Richard's circle of favourites and advisers, led to the emergence of a group known as the Lords Appellant. There were five of these lords, namely Thomas of Woodstock, who was Duke of Gloucester, a brother of Gaunt, uncle of Richard and son of Edward III, plus the Earls of Arundel, Warwick, Nottingham and Derby. This last earl was Henry Bolingbroke, son of John of Gaunt and hide-and-seek champion of the Peasants' Revolt. The word appellant is Norman French and meant one who is appealing. Richard, however, found them unappealing because what they were appealing for was the prosecution of his ministers for treason. The appellants took control, imposing a commission on the king at the so-called Wonderful Parliament of 1386. Richard found this humiliating and initially refused to attend Parliament at all, railing against his disobedient subjects and, according to some reports, threatening to seek help from his cousin, the King of France. This was an incredibly dickish thing to say. England had been at war with France for decades, and the French seemed about to invade. The King of England turning round and saying that he'd be in favour of that because his French counterpart was a relative and he'd rather submit to a posh cousin than a bunch of uppity oiks is a level of faux pas even Donald Trump couldn't get away with. In the end, Richard came to Parliament and submitted to the commission with very bad grace. But he was soon fighting back, touring the country to drum up support, establishing a personal power base in Cheshire and getting some lawyers to say that the appellants were treasonous. This led to a very short civil war in December 1387, in which Robert de Vere raised a pro-Richard army in Cheshire and marched it south to be defeated at the Battle of Radcot Bridge by the Earls of Nottingham and Derby. The appellants were more in charge than ever, and at the merciless Parliament of 1388 purged the king's administration, condemning Richard's most senior ministers to death. This included de Vere and de la Pole, but they had fled to France, so escaped execution. This might have been exciting if they hadn't both died quite soon, thanks to medieval Europe's narratively insensitive mortality rate. The king was now a puppet of the appellants. This, he must have thought, is the lowest ebb of my entire reign. It turned out to be the second lowest. The lowest came in the summer of 1399 when Henry Bolingbroke, who by this time was Duke of Lancaster as well as Earl of Derby because John of Gaunt had just died, landed with a small army on the Humber estuary and took over England pretty much unopposed. This was a sign of how unpopular Richard had made himself. For much of the previous decade, Richard had seemed like a reformed king. He still wanted peace, not war, and fancied himself high majestic ruler of the universe, as well as the most holy little slip of a boy in Christendom. But he ran a competent government from when John of Gaunt returned in 1389 until the late 1390s. However, his confidence was growing, which did him no good. Then, in 1394, his beloved wife died, which also did him no good. He became increasingly obsessed with his power base in Cheshire, which he ran like a private sub-kingdom, and by vengeance against the appellants. In September 1397, Richard orchestrated a very dodgy parliament. It was held under the armed guard of Richard's Cheshire archers, had a cravenly pro-Ricardian speaker, Sir John Bussey, and was seemingly packed with loyalists, or at least those who were put in quite a loyal mood by having a bow and arrow pointed at them. It swiftly accused three of the appellants of treason. Arundel was executed, Warwick begged not to be executed and was dispossessed of his estates and imprisoned, and Gloucester, the king's uncle who had been imprisoned in Calais, was murdered before he could even get to Parliament. This was by order of the fourth appellant, Thomas de Mowbray, Earl of Nottingham, who had defected to Richard's side. He was made Duke of Norfolk a few days later. It's all gone a bit Stalin. There are two of the appellants left standing, Mowbray, who had murdered Gloucester to show his loyalty, and Bolingbroke, who was John of Gaunt's son. They didn't feel safe, and in 1398 this very fact apparently became the subject of a quarrel between them, though we only have Bolingbroke's subsequent account of what was said. According to Bolingbroke, Mowbray warned that the king's pardons for their role as appellants were worthless and that he was going to turn on them, while Bolingbroke declared that Richard would not break his word like that. This strikes me as an implausible conversation, particularly Bolingbroke's part in it. Mowbray's fears are pretty obviously justified, and Bolingbroke's response either naive or insincere. Nevertheless, the quarrel was genuine and could not be resolved by Parliament. Richard, thrilling to the tyrannical power of it, declared that the two of them must settle their differences in a trial by combat. Then, just as the joust was beginning, he halted the proceedings and exiled them both, Mowbray for life and Bolingbroke for 10 years. As it turns out, Mowbray's was the shorter sentence. He died of plague in September 1399. Although, as it also turns out, Mowbray was still in exile for longer because by the time he died, Bolingbroke had returned to England and taken over the country. Richard was in Ireland when this happened, which was stupid of him. By the time he got back to England in July, he had no choice but to submit to his cousin. Bolingbroke had nominally come to England purely to claim his Lancastrian inheritance, which Richard had unwisely confiscated, but his ambitions were growing fast. Nobody liked Richard, and everyone liked Bolingbroke. He was son of John of Gaunt, a great figure of stability for many years. He was pious and brave. He had fought a crusade in Lithuania and been on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. He was of royal stock and martial inclination. Also, he had the support of the magnates, particularly the powerful Percy family, the Earls of Northumberland. Despite having sworn that he had no intention of taking the throne, Henry Bolingbroke had every intention of taking the throne. A Parliament of September 1399 made it so. Richard was taken to Pontefract Castle, and on the 13th of October, the feast day of St. Edward the Confessor, in your face, Richard, Henry, Duke of Lancaster, was crowned King Henry IV. What could possibly go wrong? Part 4. Everything's Coming Up Roses. Chapter 26. King Henry IV. Everyone would have been delighted by Henry if only he'd been the rightful king. He had all the qualities the magnates and commons were looking for in a ruler, except the one that would have qualified him for the job, being next in the order of succession when the previous king died. The previous king hadn't died, and even if he had, Henry wasn't next in the order of succession. Or probably not, anyway. I mean, he might have been. It depends how you look at it. Strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government, it says in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Well, neither is It Depends How You Look at It. Once a line of succession becomes open to different interpretations, it has ceased to function. That's what Edward III did to the French line of succession in the first half of the 14th century, and as a result, France spent most of the next 100 years hosting a war.